A bright spot in the Ukraine war, ships carrying wheat across the Black Sea have helped supply food to many parts of the world and stabilized world markets.
Prices worldwide are lower than they would have been otherwise.
But the deal between Ukraine and Russia could soon expire. Also ahead, some Canadian soccer fans are questioning why the men make five times more than the women, especially when it's the women who bring home the accolades.
The Canadian men haven't done a lot. In terms of who has kept this program alive, it's the women, and they are expected to do more with less.
And Cyclone Freddy is on the record books, 33 days as a cyclone and counting.
I've likened this to a bad illness you just can't clear. It just keeps coming back and bothering you.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. The British Prime Minister was in Paris today for the first bilateral summit between the UK and France in more than 5 years. Relations between the two countries have been rocky ever since Britain's exit from the European Union. On today's agenda, the war in Ukraine, energy costs, and relations with China. But the issue dominating this summit was Britain's new controversial plan to stop migrants arriving from France. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
It was all warm handshakes and pats on the back when the British Prime Minister met the French President at the Élysée Palace in Paris this morning. Rishi Sunak wanted everyone to know the two leaders are good mates, particularly after the tense years of Boris Johnson.
The relationship between our two countries has had its challenges in recent years. I feel very fortunate to be serving alongside you and incredibly excited about the future that we can build together. Merci. Mon ami.
But today's summit wasn't just about making friends. Top of Sunak's agenda, winning the French president's support for Britain's new so-called illegal migration bill.
Emmanuel and I share the same belief. Criminal gangs should not get to decide who comes to our countries.
More than 45,000 people arrived in the UK on small boats from France last year. Sunak's government announced the new bill this week, saying it would ban all migrants arriving on small boats from France. If the bill passes, undocumented migrants would either be deported back to their own country or sent on to a safe third country. But the bill says these arrivals would not be allowed to apply for asylum in Britain. Groups working with migrants and refugees say the proposed law is unnecessarily cruel.
Nobody wants to get into a dinghy and risk their life seeking sanctuary, but when there's no other option, that's the route that people have to take.
Nick Beals is with the Refugee and Migrant Forum in Essex and London.
What the impact will be, though, is it will not prevent people from making the journey across the channel. If the government was serious about preventing people from taking that journey, then what they would do is they would focus on creating safe routes for refugees to get to the UK.
The UK government knows the proposed law is likely to face many legal challenges. In fact, the EU's Home Affairs Commissioner said this week that the bill violates international law. Britain signed up to the EU Convention on Human Rights after the Second World War, but some in the ruling Conservative Party have been pushing for the UK to leave the convention. Immigration lawyer Harjab Singh Bangal says this would leave Britain in a very vulnerable position.
That would put us on par with countries such as Belarus. And, you know, other countries who've got the worst human rights records in the world. It will be seen as the fear of the foreigner is so great that Britain is willing to isolate itself on a world stage.
The British government says the proposed legislation would crack down on human traffickers too. But Harjab Singh Bangal says the plans do nothing to address that problem directly.
These gangs have been operating for 20 years from the same coast, from Calais, and they're sending people to the same coast. The British government is effectively saying we can't catch these gangs because we don't know where they are. That's almost like somebody driving a bus, the same driver, for 20 years, and then we're being told, look, you need to catch the bus driver. And the government are told, sorry, mate, don't know where he is. He's too clever for us.
Some refugee advocates say this is really all about politics. Here's Nick Beals again.
I think a big thing for the government is that they are struggling massively in opinion polls in the UK. This does seem to be an area where they think they can gain traction with voters, and appearing tough on asylum seekers and immigration is more important than actually fixing problems.
In Paris this afternoon, Rishi Sunak said a new migrant detention centre will soon open in northern France, and that Britain will pay $600 million to France to try and stop undocumented migrants from crossing the Channel in small boats. That includes an extra 500 new police officers to patrol French beaches. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Last July, there was some positive news from the war in Ukraine. Russia, with encouragement from Turkey and the United Nations, signed a deal with Ukraine, an agreement to allow Kyiv to export wheat, corn, sunflower oil, and other agricultural products. Ukraine is a major supplier of grain to the entire globe, and this deal allowed safe passage of grain from Ukrainian ports across the Black Sea and onto world markets. Well, the Black Sea Grain Initiative, as it's known, is set to expire at the end of next week. For background, we turn to Joseph Glauber. He's a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute and joins me from Rome. Joseph Glauber, remind us what this agreement has achieved so far.
Remember when, you know, the initial months after the invasion, Ukraine was unable to ship any grain out through the Black Sea. And so the Black Sea Grain Agreement couldn't have come at a better time for them. They were able to build their exports to about 5 million tons a month of grain. And that's not quite what they were doing in 2021, but it's still significantly better than what they were doing pre-agreement.
I'm curious, how much of that grain went to countries who are really in need, places like Ethiopia, Somalia, and Yemen?
Well, understand that Ukraine historically ships a lot of corn to places like China and the European Union. But about 20% of what's come out of the Gulf since the Black Sea Grain Agreement opened has gone to the Middle East and North Africa, about 10% to Sub-Saharan Africa. But I would say the other big thing to realize is to have this grain out on the market means that prices worldwide are lower than they would have been otherwise. So even developing countries that aren't direct beneficiaries in the sense of importing wheat from Ukraine, they're benefiting by the fact that, global prices are lower.
So how has this grain deal, how has it impacted Ukraine's farmers and the Ukrainian economy itself, which, of course, is in the middle of a war?
There's no question it's helped Ukrainian farmers, but there's still problems. Grain coming out of Ukraine through this Black Sea Grain Agreement has to go to Turkey where it's inspected. And unfortunately, wait times for ships going from Odessa and, the other ports to Turkey are as much as 10 days wait before they can get inspected. And that costs. Most of those costs get absorbed by producers in Ukraine. That creates strong disincentives for Ukraine producers.
Essentially, they're making less money than they used to.
Yes, exactly.
And of course, the new twist is whether Russia will renew this Black Sea Grain Initiative. What is Russia asking for? Why are they holding this up?
What Russia is asking for is that countries could import fertilizer and wheat from them with no additional cost. And they claim that the sanctions are still having impact on that.
Are the other parties to this deal, are they likely to concede to that, or is that just kind of a non-starter?
Yeah, well, the other party we're talking about is Ukraine. So, I mean, I know it's through Turkey and the United Nations, but I think the sanctions are, I think the U.S. and EU and others have said, no, we're exempting food, we're exempting fertilizer, that we're not going to impose sanctions against that.
So is there a real chance that this Black Sea Grain Initiative simply won't be renewed and we'll be back to square one in terms of getting Ukrainian grain to world markets?
Well, as you know, Russia actually suspended the agreement in November for 3 days, and for much the same reasons. There was a significant pressure on Russia at the time from a lot of neutral countries, that is, countries who have not voted against Russia in the United Nations, who are importing from Russia. They are concerned about what the impact will be for their own food security. So I think Russia actually is under a lot of global political pressure to renew.
Joseph Glauber is a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. He's been updating us on the deal set to expire that has allowed Ukrainian grain to reach world markets. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
Canada's national women's soccer team is in the middle of tense negotiations with the country's federation, Canada Soccer. Players are asking for equal pay and equal resources in the lead-up to this summer's Women's World Cup. Yesterday, team members testified to parliamentarians in Ottawa that they don't trust Canada Soccer to agree to a fair labor contract. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Canada's men's and women's national teams have been on a roll these past few years.
Book your flights, book your hotels. Canada is going to the World Cup.
Toronto and Vancouver will host World Cup games in 2026.
It's a glory goal for Canada.
International soccer icon and women's team captain Christine Sinclair started her opening statement by detailing those wins. But she said apparently they haven't been enough.
As the popularity, interest, and growth of the women's game have swept the globe, our most painstaking battle has been with our own federation and trying to obtain fair and equitable treatment in the way we are supported and the way we are paid.
The national team's midfielder, Quinn, told members of parliament that Canada Soccer spent twice the amount of money on the men's team than the women's team in 2021. In part, that difference meant the women's team couldn't afford to bring enough players to practice, so staff members had to step in for scrimmages.
I'd like to applaud our staff members for how well they play soccer, but I don't think it's at the caliber of our national team. And so I do think it impacts us when we have staff not only taking away from their active role because they're not able to perform their duties as whatever staff members that they are, but then they're jumping in on our scrimmages, not at the quality that we'd hope for our competition.
Sinclair said she has felt disrespected on a personal level, too, especially during one meeting with Canada Soccer last year.
I was tasked with outlining our compensation ask on behalf of the women's national team. The president of Canada Soccer listened to what I had to say, and then later in the meeting referred back to it as, quote, "What was it Christine was bitching about?"
The president she's referring to, Nick Bontis, resigned from Canada Soccer last week. Five-time Olympian Charmaine Crooks was quickly named acting president. Quinn said this new leadership isn't all that new.
Charmaine was a member of the board since 2013, and through her time on the board, she has not shown her support to the women's program through all of these issues that we're facing today. And so I believe that she is a part of the old guard of Canada Soccer.
The Federation did not reply to my request for comment on yesterday's testimony, though they have said they're committed to pay and resource equity. During the two-hour meeting, many viewers noticed two young girls sitting behind the players in the audience. 10-year-old Quinton and 12-year-old Charlotte Lepp are siblings who got out of school early to come watch the testimony. They wore red Canada Soccer jerseys and shook their heads as the players talked about their mistreatment.
From a political standpoint, I was like, yes, I love having, you know, young children get involved in a parliamentary process.
Laura Bryan was watching from Toronto. She's a longtime fan of the game and helps run Rise Higher, an outlet dedicated to the women's national team. Bryan says seeing the two girls at the hearing shows how much this team means to Canada.
The women have that ability to really make an impact and are really tied, I think, to the hearts of a lot of people. And I think that's what you saw when you saw those two young girls there. And that's why these players are doing what they're doing. Four girls like them that can, you know, hopefully have a different future in the sport.
Bryan says she felt both proud of the way the players handled themselves at the hearing and sad that this is what their fight has come to. The most jarring moment for her was when Sinclair revealed that in 2021, the men's team players made five times more than the women.
The Canadian men haven't done a lot. And I say that as a fan of the Canadian men. I go to their games in Toronto, but I think in terms of who has kept this program alive, it's the women, and they are expected to do more with less. And the fact that they are paid five times less, that was shocking to me.
Members of Parliament will next hear from Canada Soccer. The Federation is scheduled to testify on March 20th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Coming up, China's Xi Jinping cements his hold on power, picking up yet another title. The buck stops with him, up, down, and sideways.
It appears right now that he is the sole decision maker, but he also appears to be the sole potential point of failure in the system.
Xi Jinping's tightening grip on power and what that could mean for China, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has started his third term as general secretary, surprising pretty much no one. See, he was already president, but general secretary is the position where the real power lies. A lot of power for one man, and Xi Jinping has his work cut out for him. To learn more about the challenges China faces, we called Robert Daly. He's the head of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. Robert, first of all, let's get wonky. What's the difference between president and the general secretary in China?
Xi Jinping, like his two predecessors, holds three different titles. He's the chairman of the Central Military Commission, which makes him commander-in-chief. He's also president, which is a largely ceremonial title that doesn't confer any real power. His power comes from being general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and it is from that seat that he exercises his power.
And is that power based on the fact that he can say, okay, we're doing this and the party has to follow? Or is it more layered than that?
The Chinese Communist Party has always been a black box. They work in secret of necessity, so we guess. We have something called Pekingology. Even given how opaque the system is, Xi Jinping operates in extreme secrecy, and we know very little about who he listens to or whether and how he shops ideas around. It appears right now that he is the sole decision maker, but he also appears to be the sole potential point of failure in the system.
So what are the biggest challenges Xi Jinping and the Communist Party want to tackle?
Xi Jinping has domestic as well as international challenges. His big domestic challenge is that the Chinese economy is slowing down. Chinese leaders have seen this coming for a long time. They knew that this export-driven model that made China, like many other Asian nations, rich wouldn't last forever. So the economy is slowing down, and that is happening at the same time that China's population is both shrinking and getting older. And he would love to be able to spend all of his attention on that. He can't do so because under the first 10 years of Xi's leadership, China's relationship with the U.S. has gone down the tubes. We are now essentially in a new kind of Cold War footing, and that requires a great deal of the Chinese Communist Party's attention.
That's a lot to deal with. Do we know what Xi Jinping's next move is going to be?
We can be quite sure that Xi's primary focus is on domestic issues, because his goal is always to maintain the Chinese Communist Party's monopoly on power. And the Chinese people have become accustomed over the past 40 years to continued increases of their standard of living. And it is delivering those increases in standards of living that has been the primary source of the party's legitimacy. So Xi Jinping would like to shore up at home, but he keeps on getting pulled back to the international sphere. And frankly, part of that is also China's doing, because under Xi Jinping, China has said that it will have a more active foreign policy and will at last take a central role in world affairs. So it's not just that the United States is picking on China, it's that Xi Jinping made his big international moves before the very bad demographic economic news hit China.
Now, there's another new face in the party leadership in China, Li Qiang. He's basically Xi's number two guy. What's his story?
He is going to be the premier, as you say, the number two. And traditionally, by which we mean over the past 30 years or so, the premier who is supposed to see all of the operations of government has been the leader on economic policy. Li Qiang gets fairly high marks from foreign business people who have dealt with him in Shanghai. He's someone who wants to get rid of red tape, streamline applications in a business-friendly way, and he does have some economic credentials. The question is whether he will have a different, meaning a more reformist or more open view than Xi Jinping's, and whether he would be able to convey that to Xi and actually convince Xi. To date, there's no sign of that. The problem Xi faces with this domestic agenda versus his international agenda is that improving the Chinese economy would seem to require more openness, devolving more power to the Chinese private sector. But that means less power for the Communist Party, and Xi feels that he needs that power in order to fend off the United States. So the economic and the international agendas are somewhat at odds with each other.
What about at the top of the Communist Party leadership in China? Is there any sense that there are squabbles about the right direction China should go in? Is everybody in agreement? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, this is, again, like many things under Xi Jinping, it's something of a new situation. We know from our really exhaustive study of the history of the Chinese Communist Party that there have always been factions. There have always been groups that come out of different power centers within China who have shared power since the death of Mao Zedong, and who have squabbled privately, but sometimes publicly. We also were aware of different factions. Now, these were not like the Republicans and Democrats. They were not at daggers drawn, but they had different points of emphasis and different patronage networks within the party. Under Xi Jinping, we cannot see it. We don't see factionalism that we know must be at least nascent because it's always been there. And we know that through prosecuting his anti-corruption campaign, and we know that through COVID policies, Xi Jinping has undoubtedly made enemies there. We know that there are doubters and naysayers. We sometimes get hints of this from essays by Chinese who make it out of China. But in fact, day to day, we can't see it. It appears to be the Xi Jinping show all the way.
That's amazing. So, Robert, what about all this interests you the most personally?
If we just look at Xi Jinping, trying to understand him, one of the questions has been, why is it that this guy who suffered so much during Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution, who saw his father abused, whose sister was driven to suicide by the excesses of the Cultural Revolution, why does he emerge as the most Maoist leader in China since 1976? What does that mean? But the other question, I think the bigger question going forward is this. We know that there is opposition to Xi among urban intellectuals, but it appears that Xi has strong support from the military, from the security services, which are powerful and vast, and he also appears to have broad support. It's hard to tell in a country with no elections and no polling. That is to say, most Chinese seem to support Xi. But does support for Xi mean that they understand and genuinely approve of the direction in which he's taken the country? You know, China, if you go to China and you go to the cities there, you will find young, entrepreneurial, innovative, energetic, proud people working very hard. I've lived there for about 12 years, and I've lived among these folks a long time. And what most of them would like to see is a China in which the great Chinese cities like Beijing, Shanghai, and Shenzhen are mentioned in the same sentence with Tokyo and Seoul and New York and LA and Paris and Milan and Berlin. And instead, Xi Jinping is giving them Tehran, Havana, Caracas, Moscow, and Pyongyang. And I strongly suspect that most of the people who broadly support Xi don't really support that direction. And we will continue to see growing signs of fissures. I'm not talking about rebellion, but real stress that is cultural, social, and could become political between the Chinese Communist Party and the people, a growing number of whom have grown up in relative wealth and relatively integrated with the rest of the world, and people who like that integration.
Robert Daly is the head of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. Robert, thank you so much. Really interesting.
Thank you.
There's much more to come in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. Two kids from southern Ethiopia get handed a Cirque du Soleil VHS tape in the mid-1990s.
We actually fell in love with that video. The music, the lighting, all the stage arrangement.
How the human body can do all those sort of things. We were amazed. We never seen those kind of things before.
And a brother circus act is born. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Some big news today in the world of Middle East diplomacy. Iran and Saudi Arabia, two of the most powerful players in the Middle East, decided to reestablish full diplomatic relations today. The two nations have been at odds for years. The reconciliation process will take place over the next 2 months, and it's being brokered by China, an ally of both countries. To break all this down, we're joined by Dina Esfandiari. She's a senior advisor with the International Crisis Group and joins us from Qatar. Dina, Saudi Arabia and Iran, they've been at odds for a long time. What do you think the motivations are for restoring relations now? I mean, for both parties.
I think this has been a long time in the making. The two have been talking to each other for over a year now in a kind of stop-start way, and the negotiations have been pretty difficult. So the expectation wasn't that they would come to an agreement on restoring diplomatic ties, but it's definitely good news that that is the outcome.
And can you briefly remind us what the rift is between these two nations?
So the difficulties between the two countries are really quite wide-ranging. The tensions have been also wide-ranging. The two countries just see the region and the world very differently. They also see the security of the region differently. Saudi Arabia would rather the region had as many players in it, including the U.S., whereas Iran believes that regional security should be indigenous to the region. But in 2016, there was the hanging of a Shia cleric, Nimr al-Nimr, in Saudi Arabia. And that sparked further tensions between the two countries and also an Iranian attack on the Saudi embassy, I believe, in Tehran. And so they broke off diplomatic relations, and things have been really, really difficult since then between the two.
It's interesting. This is also a major diplomatic victory for China, which is brokering this deal. It really engages Beijing as a player in the Middle East. What does China hope to gain here?
China's been involved in the region for a very long time. It's just that its involvement has generally not been a political one. It's been a heavy economic involvement. What's different is now it's becoming increasingly politically involved in the region, which traditionally is a role that is reserved for the United States. So this is a win for China. It's also a win for Iran and Saudi Arabia, because for the Iranians, it's important because they're quite isolated at the moment. And for Saudi Arabia, it's important because it's facing increasing pressure from the Biden administration to act a certain way on a range of issues, and it doesn't want to. So for all the countries involved, it's quite important to highlight China's role in this.
Now, what effect do you think the reestablishing of diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran will have on the conflict in Yemen, where both Iran and Saudi Arabia are deeply entrenched?
So firstly, you'll have to see how that plays out and how easy it is to reestablish those ties. And then you'll be able to move on to the impact this might have on different conflicts in the region where the two countries are competing, again, for influence, security, etc. Yemen is one of those countries. There is potential for an improvement in the situation. The Saudis have been talking to the Houthi rebel group now for several months, and Iran has influence over this group. So there is the potential for a deal, but it really, really remains to be seen whether we'll get there or not.
We're also seeing reports of Saudi Arabia signaling it could make peace with Israel, normalizing relations in exchange for nuclear technology. How likely do you think that scenario is?
So I unfortunately do not think that's likely anytime soon. A lot of other things have to happen for Saudi Arabia to accept normalization with Israel. Saudi still has to get its domestic population used to the idea of normalization with Israel, something that they're not quite on board with yet. The reports that we've been hearing about the Saudi conditions for normalization are things that the Saudis have already asked of the United States. For example, discussions on nuclear technology, well, these have been ongoing for several years now, and they were never a condition. The United States has been talking to the Saudis on the transfer of nuclear technology and on their civilian program for several years. So none of that is new. What's new is that they're linking it to normalization now. And that's probably because they want to up the pressure on the Biden administration and really get something for it in return.
Now, the region has witnessed a lot of instability for decades, really. But now things seem to be shifting towards diplomacy on a number of fronts. Why do you think that is?
We've descended into an era of pragmatism where many of the main players have realized that actually containment or aggressive rhetoric on its own will not succeed in lessening tensions. So there's been a bit of a reshift in focus where that containment still happens, but it's accompanied with a restoration of relations or diplomatic ties, or at the very least, dialogue amongst various countries in the region in order to shift and build alliances against security threats.
Dina Esfandiari is a senior advisor with the International Crisis Group. She joined us from Qatar. Dina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You may remember this story about an environmental disaster waiting to happen in Yemen.
Just off the coast sits a decaying oil tanker, ready to burst.
On board are more than 1.1 million barrels of oil.
Yesterday, the United Nations announced that it has a solution, a replacement oil tanker.
a very large crude carrier or a VLCC.
But as the UN's Achim Steiner explains, very large oil tankers do not come cheap.
The price for this vessel has been a painful $55 million.
The ship is currently under repair in China. It could sail to Yemen as early as May. A salvage team will pump the oil out of the old tanker and into the new one, averting a massive oil spill and environmental disaster. This operation will cost about $100 million before it's done. Washington has stepped up to help, but the UN is waiting for other countries to pay their share. The UN's top humanitarian official in Yemen, David Gressley, gave a shout-out yesterday to one funding source.
In Bethesda, Maryland, there is an elementary school there, a green club that mobilized $200 by selling lemonade.
Turning lemonade into Yemen aid. Japanese society has been grappling with some uncomfortable topics around sex. The age of consent there is 13, the lowest among all G7 countries. New legislation would raise that age to 16 and make other changes to toughen penalties for sex crimes. But many in Japan say the new law isn't tough enough. From Tokyo, Chisanka Sirpala reports.
Hundreds of people took to the streets in Tokyo to demand gender equality. The message of Japan's Women's Day rally was clear: my body, my choice. We oppose violence. Data released last year by the Japan Cabinet Office suggests that 1 in 13 women are victims of rape or sexual assault, but it also shows that roughly half of victims don't tell anyone about it. University student Yuki Nakamura is 21. At the rally, she said that sex and sexual assault are taboo topics in Japan.
Yes is yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And no is no. This is the
consent.
Yeah, consent is the main and the basic knowledge, but many Japanese people don't understand that.
Japan is poised to raise its legal age of consent for the first time in more than 100 years, from 13 to 16. Japan's legal consent is the lowest among G7 nations. The age of consent is 16 in Britain, 15 in France, and 14 in Germany and Italy. If the legislation is passed, and all indications are that it will, all forms of sexual activity with children under 16 will become a crime, unless the two parties are minors or there is less than a 5-year age gap. Attorney Sakura Kamitani specializes in sex crimes. She says allowing for a 5-year age gap could still lead to abuse. Kamitani says teaching students about consent is crucial in the fight against sexual abuse. But in Japan, sex education isn't mandatory at schools, and no such curriculum exists, she says, which leaves children vulnerable. Teaching elementary and middle school children about pregnancy and childbirth itself is considered acceptable, she says, but they're not allowed to teach about steps that lead to pregnancy. A 2020 survey by a child sex abuse advocacy group found that 25% of respondents had been touched inappropriately by a teacher while at school. The proposal to change the age of consent comes after discussion with experts. But survivors say change has been painfully slow. It was only last year that a law was passed making it difficult for teachers who've been dismissed for sexual abuse to be hired again. Ikuko Ishida is a child sex abuse survivor and founder of Be Brave Japan. She says the problem with this is that teachers who groom students are able to stay in the school system. The education ministry requires that teachers who sexually assault students be fired, she says. But this actually doesn't happen in each prefectural education board. They don't do proper background checks on teachers. As a part of the reforms on sexual offence laws, the statute of limitations for children who experience sexual abuse will be raised by 5 years to 15 years. But in Ishida's case, it took her decades to realise that she was sexually abused by her teacher. The 5-year extension to the statute of limitations is not enough, she says. In my survey on school sex abuse, 1/3 of respondents took more than 11 years to realise they'd been victimized. I think we should abolish the statute of limitations or set it at 30 years. As a part of Japan's review of sexual offence laws, the Justice Ministry has laid out more clearly what the conditions for forced sex are for adults. It will be expanded to include adults not being able to give consent as a result of alcohol, drugging, and freezing in fear. But the most controversial conditions remain. The prosecution must prove that the perpetrator used violence or threats and it was impossible for the victim to resist. Japanese attorney Shiny Fan was also at the Women's Day rally. She said the law makes it difficult to prosecute sex crimes in court.
Evidentiary burden, like that requires people to prove that they were raped or sexually assaulted. There's so much burden placed on the victim. And it's very hard to prove that you've been sexually assaulted, so people just don't even come forward.
University student Yuki Nakamura believes Japanese society makes it difficult to talk openly about it.
In Japan, women are always located under the men. It's not really explicit, but I feel so. So I can understand how difficult it is to speak about these problems.
Many women in Japan are fed up with Japan's conservative attitude towards sexual violence, and momentum is growing to modernize Japan's sexual assault laws. Parliament is expected to take up the revisions by this summer. For The World, I'm Tisanka Sirapala in Tokyo.
Now, a story about playing with fire, literally, and never giving up on your dreams. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
Brothers Bishu and Bibi Tesfamariam can pinpoint the day their lives changed. It was 1996 in the town of Jima, Ethiopia. They were hanging out at recess, and their French teacher picked up a few oranges and started juggling.
And as soon as we saw that, we were like, oh my God, this is it.
This is Bibi. He was 15 at the time. He and his brother had never seen anyone juggle before. They peppered the teacher with questions.
And then he was just telling us he was from Canada, and there was a circus called Cirque du Soleil. And he does this just as a hobby.
This is Bishu. He was 13.
And then we were just like, wow, we would love to learn. And then he said, come back tomorrow morning.
The teacher came back the next day with a Cirque du Soleil video, which the brothers would watch ad nauseum for the next 6 months.
The music, the lighting, all the stage arrangement.
How the human body can do all those sort of things. We were amazed. We never seen those kind of things before.
We actually fell in love with that video.
Circus wasn't a part of Ethiopian culture then. But after seeing that tape, the brothers became obsessed.
We never stopped juggling after that. Every day, we used to get in trouble with the parents because African parents said that we need to go to school, do well, be a doctor or engineer or lawyer or whatever, something like that.
Adding to their parents' irritation, there were cut-up socks all over the house. Why? The boys had taken to making their own juggling balls by cutting the family's socks in two and stuffing them with seeds. A little later, they moved on to a different material. They made juggling clubs out of solid wood in the school workshop.
The clubs are so heavy
and they hurt. We used to bleed and all that kind of stuff.
But the thing is, I think those are the advantage we had. When we come to the Western countries and when we had the proper juggling club, it was so easy for us because literally it was plastic, throwing a plastic thing. And comparing to what we used to, this was just nothing for us.
In the late 90s, the brothers started training in acrobatics at a local school. They were invited to join a circus tour in South Africa and then in Europe, where they got discovered by a talent scout.
Me and Bibi were passing to each other with lots of clubs, like 10 clubs, and the juggling scout, they came to us and said, how did you manage to do this? And the thing is, we were self-taught as well. So every juggling routine you do, there is a name for it. When this guy approached us and said, oh, you're doing this trick. And me and my brother was just like, we're a crazy man. What are you talking about?
Do you remember what the name of the trick is?
It's called popcorn, I think.
Bibi and Bishu learned how to do it all. Popcorn, Ultimate Zip, Benny's Nightmare, French Techno. But their favorite?
I love fire.
In their clips on YouTube, the brothers juggle flaming torches while weaving in and around each other. It's insane.
Fire juggling is just the most exciting thing.
What's the term for fire juggling?
That's just like fire juggling.
Okay, then. Bibi Mbishu moved to London in 1999 and carved out a successful career, but they knew they wanted to do something to honor their roots. So in 2010, they started sponsoring a circus school back home, and from there, they put together their own company. It's called Circus Abyssinia, and its mission is to showcase Ethiopian talent. Everyone in the company is from Ethiopia, and to highlight Ethiopian stories, music, and choreography. Their latest show is called Tulu. It's inspired by the Ethiopian runner Durartu Tulu.
Tulu of Ethiopia.
The first Black African woman to win an Olympic gold in 1992. Circus Abyssinia honors her with feats of strength and agility, juggling, tumbling, contorting, hoop diving, and this should surprise no one, lots of fire. The brothers have already been all over the world with Tulu, and they plan to continue touring with the show for the rest of the year while they line things up for the next phase of their dream.
We want the African people to experience what a big top circus is. Hopefully, buy a big top and ship it back to Ethiopia and tour around, giving access to the people who never experienced what circus is.
They're betting that somewhere, maybe in a small town in Ethiopia, there are two little boys who have everything it takes to be great performers. All they need is for Bibi and Bishu Tesfamariam to light a fire. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Cyclone Freddy is now officially the longest living cyclone ever recorded. It formed in the Indian Ocean 33 days ago and is still wreaking havoc. It's now off the coast of southeastern Africa. The World Meteorological Organization says Freddy is one of the strongest storms ever recorded in the southern hemisphere. It's led to the deaths of at least 27 people in Mozambique and Madagascar. Nearly 200,000 people have been impacted. I'm joined by meteorologist Jeff Masters with Yale Climate Connections. Jeff, 33 days is a new record for tropical cyclones. How out of the ordinary is the longevity of this cyclone?
We've only ever seen one storm worldwide that's lasted more than 30 days before, and that was way back in 1994. Usually land gets in the way of these systems, so they don't last that long. But Freddy has actually made two landfalls, one in Madagascar and one in Mozambique, and managed to go back out over the water after both landfalls, so it resurrected itself.
That's amazing. Where's Freddy headed now?
Freddy's about to make its second landfall in Mozambique, which is expected on Saturday. But we're not totally sure about that. It's only moving at about 5 miles per hour, and it's possible it'll go inland and then pop back out over water and re-intensify again next week.
What are the conditions that have caused this particular cyclone to last so long?
It occurred at the peak of the southern hemisphere summer when water temperatures are at their warmest. And hurricanes like to have warm water to feed the energy of their winds. So you're more likely to get strong storms this time of year. And it just happened to get lucky, just very unusual atmospheric conditions that conspired to keep this storm moving on a long track over the Indian Ocean. So combination of climatology and luck, and we could maybe even throw a little bit of climate change in there to boost the water temperatures to help it stay alive longer.
Well, I was just going to ask how climate change might be affecting the longevity of cyclones in general.
We are seeing a lengthening of the cyclone season in a lot of ocean basins, though that's not for sure yet. We're hampered by our inability to express in climatological terms how things are changing. We've only got about 30 years of data over the South Indian Ocean from satellites, and that's really too short a period to say whether or not the climate is changing in respect to these storms or not.
Now, this cyclone, Freddy, is moving slowly. How does that affect its destructive impact on land?
Slow-moving storms are worse because they provide a longer period of extreme weather where they make landfall. In particular, Freddy's rains are going to be at least 15 to 20 inches along the coast, and that's partially because the storm is moving so slow. And we are wondering now with climate change whether that is causing more slow-moving storms. Potentially, the upper-level winds that guide these storms are weakening in the tropics, causing slower-moving, longer-lasting storms, which can cause more damage.
Now, are there any signs that Freddy may die down soon?
Once it hits land, it is forecast to die down on Saturday and Sunday. but it is going to maintain a very slow motion, keeping part of its circulation over water. It'll continue to feed off those warm waters and provide a lot of rainfall. And if it does pop back over the water, like we have some of our models expecting, it will regenerate yet again.
So, Jeff, as a meteorologist, are you just kind of watching this with your mouth agape? I mean, you're kind of going, geez, what's next with Freddie?
Yeah, I've likened this to a bad illness you just can't clear. It just keeps coming back and bothering you. And this is certainly a once-in-a-lifetime sort of storm. I've never seen anything like this before.
Jeff Masters is meteorologist for Yale Climate Connections. Thanks so much, Jeff.
You're welcome, Carol.
The Major League Baseball season kicks off in 3 weeks. But for those who just can't wait, the World Baseball Classic is going down right now. The World's Jason Margolis has been watching.
It's kind of like baseball's version of the World Cup, just with like a billion fewer viewers, at least. Still, it's a pretty big deal in parts of Asia and Latin America. And Major League Baseball wants you to know this is some high-quality stuff.
The world gathers to watch baseball unite nations. And while the calendar says March, the baseball feels like October.
20 teams from 20 nations are squaring off right now in Phoenix, Miami, Tokyo, and Taiwan. Most of baseball's household names are taking part. The winning team will be crowned in 11 days in Miami. The World Baseball Classic began back in 2006 and happens every 4 years, at least when a pandemic doesn't spoil the fun. The usual powerhouses are there again, the Americans, Cubans, Dominicans, and Japanese. Then, some surprises.
Team Great Britain, they
the
won
British
a qualifying tournament in Regensburg, Germany during the course of the spring. And
more video from MLB there. And perhaps even more surprising than the Brits.
First pitch to Angel Beltre may have done it. A grounder to first. It's a new day on the international landscape. The Czech Republic is headed to the World Baseball Classic.
Yep. The Czech Republic qualified. Not exactly top of mind when you think of hotbeds of baseball. What's most remarkable about this Czech team is the roster. It's filled with regular guys.
This Czech team, some of these guys have regular 9-to-5 jobs and they're up against MLB All-Stars.
We're not pros, but I want the feeling that we are the pros.
Major League Baseball, which helps put on this event, has been loving this storyline. The other cool thing here, the Czech players are all pretty much Czech. What I mean by this is that some teams employ totally legit but pretty loose nationality rules. For example, the Israeli team is filled with Jewish Americans. The team has one player born in Israel. One. 44-year-old pitcher Shlomo Lippitz. And you know Shlomo isn't getting the ball with the game on the line. The Dutch team is filled with guys from Curaçao and Aruba. The other feel-good story, the British team, not so inspiring when you look at where their players are from. A roster littered with Americans. Check out this interview with one of the British stars.
Harry, your parents were both born in Great Britain. How do you put into words what this means to them based on seeing them follow your journey?
I think it's a very special moment for them, almost probably more special than it is for me.
Nothing personal here against Harry Ford from Kennesaw, Georgia, but come on. The Czech team, they're Czech to the bone.
My name is Martin Snyder. I'm a fireman. And I'm a pitcher.
My name is Pavel Khadim. I'm a neurologist and I'm manager of Czech national team.
Team Czech is listed as 40,000-1 to win the World Baseball Classic. But last night in the opening game,
ground ball to the right side. Stopped there by Mushik.
The Czechs beat China in a dramatic ninth inning comeback.
Small country, big dreams. Czech Republic, you ain't dreaming. You just won your first World Baseball Classic game.
Tomorrow, the Czech Republic takes on Japan, a team stacked with multi-million-dollar superstars. It's a David versus nine Goliath story. Only this time, David doesn't have a slingshot. He's a Czech firefighter taking the mound armed with an 83-mile-per-hour fastball. For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
Bottom of the ninth for us here, too. The world comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here on Monday for another spin of the world.
From PRX.